is a messy process under the best of circumstances, but it's especially hard when we lose somebody who played a pivotal but not necessarily positive role in our lives. When Obed Silva learned his father had died, he knew he needed to return to Mexico to bury him. He didn't really know how to feel. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Silva's parents split up when he was very young, so he was mostly raised by his mother in the U.S. Most of his time with his dad took place in Chihuahua, Mexico, where his father had formed another family, but that one was also scarred by his inability to put their needs ahead of his insatiable taste for alcohol. He could be deeply and openly affectionate, but also violent, petty, and self-centered. He was a naturally gifted painter who was tutored by one of contemporary Mexico's most celebrated artists, but made his living as a plasterer because greatness as a painter required a level of discipline he could not or would not devote. So how could Silva mourn the loss of a father who was at once too much and not enough? And how would he need to come to terms with the ways they were different and the ways they were alike? Obed Silva is professor of English at East Los Angeles College. His memoir is called The Death of My Father, the Pope. Obed, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you. So your dad died in 2009 when he was only 48 years old. Did the call come as a surprise to you when it came?
It did, although it shouldn't have, because prior to that, the month leading up to his death, you know, he was losing a lot of blood and having to be restocked with blood. But nonetheless, I didn't expect my father to die that soon, especially at the young age of 48. I'm 42 now, so that's only 6 years away from when he died.
How had you responded? He'd had health crises kind of leading up to his death. How had you responded when you heard about those?
Well, you know, because he was an alcoholic, I wasn't very concerned about it. I thought it just came with the territory. I thought he'd live longer. But, you know, I was a little bit indifferent to it, especially because my father had the tendency of wanting to get money out of me often when we spoke. So I always thought that, you know, him telling me that he had to go to the hospital because he was losing blood was always kind of like a ploy to get me to send him money. But of course, when he passed away, I realized that that wasn't just the case.
Did you have the sense that he wanted more from you than money, that he wanted you to know, or he wanted to know that you loved him?
I want to say yes, but I don't think so. Knowing my father the way that I do and the way that he was, especially in the last months and years of his life, no, he only had one resolution, one goal, and that was to drink every day. So no, there was, I don't think he wanted me to tell him that I loved him or that he wanted some kind of recognition from his son. I think my father knew that I loved him. So I don't think that was a concern of his. I think his concern was, you know, maintaining his alcoholism and having the money to purchase a caguama or a fifth of tequila a day.
Do you remember confronting him about his drinking when you were small?
No, not when I was small. I always knew that my father had an alcohol problem or that he drank often, but not, he never did it in front of me. That is to say, he never got totally intoxicated or drunk to, you know, the level that I saw once I became an adult. So he had this tendency to be able to hide his alcoholism, although I knew about his alcoholism because my mom always spoke about it. You know, she would always say, your father's an alcoholic. That's why I left him. He, you know, he would abuse me, my mother. He would hit my mother. So I was always aware of those things. But in front of me as a child, he never presented those characteristics.
But when he died, initially you thought, I'm not going to go to the funeral. And it was your mother who convinced you to go. Why did she think it was important for you?
You know, my mother is a very wise person. You know, they always say your mother's always right. And, you know, that's something I've come to accept and really embrace as an adult. But as a young, you know, a teenager or a child, it was like, no, mom is not always right. But yeah, you know, I didn't want to go because, you know, as I keep saying, in the last months, our relationship had really deteriorated and it was very tumultuous to the point that we were causing violence to one another. So when I received the news that he passed away, I didn't think there was anything beneficial to come from me visiting or, you know, being there at his funeral and laying him to rest. But of course, again, as I say, my mother being the sage individual that she is, she told me, you have to go. You have to put this away or else you're going to regret it later. And it's going to be something that you're going to live with for the rest of your life. And so I followed her instructions. I followed her advice and I went. And she was right, you know, and I think writing the book was part of the grieving process. At least for me, that's the way I was able to get my father out of me, spiritually, mentally, emotionally. And, you know, when I finished the book and I sent it off to the publisher, it was a great relief. And it was like I was done grieving. So I really thank my mom for that advice.
We should step back and say that although your father didn't ultimately find success and he didn't come from money, he was a really talented artist. What was his work like?
His work as an artist?
Yeah.
I'm not quite well, I can't tell you firsthand because I was too young to experience, you know, when he was working under Piñamora, when Aaron Piñamora, who is the famous contemporary muralist and painter of Mexico, who also passed away in 2009, the same year that my father passed away. But I know that he was a great artist because we have artworks from my father. The print that is on the cover of the book is from one of my father's sketches of me. But I knew that my father was talented because my mother would always tell me. And, you know, when I was barely born, we lived in the home of Aaron Piñamora. And all my father had to do was paint with the master. You know, wake up in the morning as soon as the sun rose and, you know, end the day when the sun came down. And, you know, he did that for a few months, but after a while, the alcohol just consumed him and his desire to drink instead of paint took over. And so, you know, his talent became bastardized and it was something that he didn't pursue. And it's something that saddens me because I'm an artist, I'm a painter. And every time I think about, you know, how great my father could have been had he pursued painting, had he refined his skills, especially under the tutelage of such a great master, I become depressed. I become sad. And it's just terrible to think about that. My father was a great artist, but he let that go and, you know, pursued, you know, he made his livelihood from being a plasterer, from drywall and construction. And so he became a laborer for the rest of his life.
Do you have the sense that he chose drinking over art, drinking over family, drinking over everything else, or that he was powerless to make a choice?
Yeah, you know, I think he was powerless. My family, my uncles, his brothers and sisters, they're all alcoholics, probably with the exception of one. But they're all alcoholics. I'm an alcoholic. My siblings on my father's side drink heavily. Some have been rehab recently for alcohol and other substances. My cousins, both on this side of the border and in Mexico, suffer from alcoholism. So it's something that I think it's deeply embedded within the genes of our Silva family. And it's sad to think of it that way because, you know, if it were a choice, I would want to believe that my father would choose family over alcohol. But so I don't think it was a choice. I think he was definitely powerless, especially to die at such a young age, 48. I would want to also believe that my father would have wanted to live much longer than just up to 48.
Are you a sober alcoholic now?
I am not, frankly. I am not a sober alcoholic. In the past few months, I've tried to cut back, and I'm doing all right. You know, it's not something that gets in the way of my work or anything like that. But, you know, when the weekend comes, I am one of those people that like to binge on alcohol.
I thought your candor in writing about your drinking was really astonishing. Lots of people write about drinking too much, you know, after they've sort of come out on the other side of it. Not only do you give us that, but you give us a reason to worry about you. You know, you're at your father's funeral and he has died from drinking, and you talk about really all you want to do is get drunk again.
Right. Yeah. You know, I guess where I find the balance, or where the balance comes from, is my mother. Because, you know, you have devil and angel, where, you know, my father in this case would be the devil on one side, and is what attracts me to alcohol or pulls me to the alcohol. And then I have my mother on the other side, who's constantly telling me, don't drink because you're going to harm your body at the least, or die at the most. And so between that tug of war, you know, I'm always hoping that my mother's on the winning side. Because if she's on the winning side, that means I'm on the winning side. And she's often the reason why I don't just dive headfirst into just alcoholism and let myself just go to it. And like I said, it's a struggle. Every day is a struggle.
Your father used to tell you, los hombres no lloran, which means men don't cry. But he cried the first time he saw you in your chair.
Yeah, he did. You know, my father cried often. It's just a saying. he cried often, you know, and he wasn't shy to do it in front of you. He wept like a baby. But yeah, the first time he saw me, he cried. And I'm glad that he did, because it actually showed me that he cared, that there was something in there hurting him, for me being the way that I was now, you know, in a wheelchair.
You have memories from before this time of like this one day, or maybe it was multiple times, but your dad took you to the pool, and in those moments, he became the father everybody wanted. What do you remember about those days?
Yeah, you know, in Chihuahua, there isn't much to do. I mean, I just returned from Chihuahua and it's grown. Oh my God, boy, has it grown. But back then, you know, when I was young, when I was not even a teenager, my father would take us to the swimming pools, water parks. You know, they're not elaborate water parks like the ones we have in the United States, like Soak City and over here in Buena Park by Knott's Berry Farm or anything like that. But, you know, they're parks where they have a bunch of pools and they have slides and things like that. And you could camp and cook and things of that nature. And it was one of the places that my father would take us every time that I went to visit him during the summers that my mother would send me out to Chihuahua. And my father was very charismatic. He always smiled. He was always laughing. You know, he was those type of persons that didn't take life too seriously, or the stresses of life. And this would come out, or this part of him would mostly come out when, you know, we were having a great time. And in these swimming pools, my father would become kind of like the center of attention for other kids, because he would, you know, there's this thing that you do in the swimming pool where you put your feet on the palms of somebody and they kind of like raise you up and down, and then they toss you over their shoulders behind their head, and you kind of like do a flip and fall and dive into the water. And so my father was doing that to me and my brothers and sister, and all the kids that were in the swimming pool just like lined up for my father to do the same to them. So he became kind of like the cool dad, the dad that every child in that swimming pool wanted to have. And, you know, my father said no to none of them. He was like, come on, let's do it. So, yeah, those are those moments that I'll never forget, where my father was the father that I always wanted him to be.
By the time you were 10, you started referring to him by this nickname, Way. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, Way. I mean, it's a At first, and I don't remember, I don't know where the term wake comes from in Mexico as a term of offense, or when people started using it commonly. But now it's very commonly used. I mean, you turn on the television or you watch movies in Spanish, well, from Mexico, you know, a lot of the characters will refer to themselves as wey. And it's become a term of endearment. Hey, wey, come here, right? And the similarities that I draw, or what I closely connected to in English, is the word fool. Not fool in the sense that you're a fool, like an idiot, but you know, young people say, hey, fool, especially it's a Los Angeles thing, I think. I don't know if in New York they would do the same thing, or in the East Coast, or maybe even in the South. But over here in the West Coast, young people use it all the time. Hey, fool, what are you doing today? Right? And sometimes you don't even hear the L, it's just the FOO. So the word way takes on a similar existence, a similar a form of expression. But you know, in the book, I always say, this is telling me to dial in manually. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, so I'm not sure what's going on, but keep
Okay,
talking
something
until we
just.
lose you.
All right, great. So yeah, the word way, you know, it's in Mexico, when they started using it originally, was to refer to a husband whose wife was cheating on him. And the connection I make is to the word cuckold, which is a Middle English word that means the same thing. But nonetheless, I conclude that it's a word that you shouldn't say to a father. But you know, after our relationship became tumultuous, it was often that instead of calling him father or papa or pa or padre, I just referred to him as wey, you know, just the same way that I would refer to a friend. So what I did was kind of like I had demeaned him, I had demoted him from father to just like a common friend, or an associate, actually, not even a friend. So yeah, I would call my father wey in all the way up until he passed away, unfortunately.
Tell us, Obed, about this time that you hatched a plot to have your father, I guess, beat up by some people.
Yeah, again, violence was a recurring theme in the household, in my father's home. And of course, this is in Chihuahua, but those last years where I go visit my father, I just got to see this. He unmasked himself and showed his violent side. And a night after we'd had a fight house, I came up with a plot to have my father brutally beaten by some young gang members that I had become acquainted with from childhood. Through my twin cousins, who, you know, unfortunately have passed away, are deceased now. And so I plotted this in my mind. I mean, I didn't call these people beforehand or anything like that. I just thought, well, I'll drive my father into that neighborhood. I'll come across some of these guys, and I'll ask them to beat my father up, and they'll do it for me because, you know, they're friends of mine from childhood. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, that wasn't the case, because when we arrived there, these young men whom I had thought would be willing to do this job for me were resistant, and they were like, no, why do you want us to beat up your father? And I was trying to explain to them why. And you know, I was intoxicated at the time too, and my father was too. And I even offered them $100. I was like, here's $100, just beat him up, man. And you know, while I was having this conversation with these young men, my father was a few feet away buying tortas off of a, you know, a food truck or a food stand. And so in the moment, I was really disappointed because I thought, I mean, this is Mexico, right? And it's like supposed to be violent, and it's not supposed to be a big deal to pay some people off to beat somebody up. But these young men, you know, contrary to that belief, they were like, no, man, that's not a good idea. Why would you want to beat your father up? Why would you want us to do that? And so they didn't do it. And my father caught whiff of kind of like what I was intending to do. And he just ran away. And that scene was pretty comical to me because I was like, "Dad, where are you going?" And he's kind of like running away, looking back at me with that face of like, "I know what you're trying to do, and it's not going to happen." But I'm grateful. I'm grateful that those young men didn't listen to me and didn't take the $100 offer and didn't beat up my father, because I probably would be regretting that dearly now.
People might be wondering at this point, Obed, why the book is called The Death of My Father, the Pope. Papa, in this case, is kind of a play on words in your family, right?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a play on words. I mean, but where it actually comes from is that we often would drive to Koki's house because for some time Koki's and my father didn't live in the same homes. So we would make this drive to Koki's house, and on that drive, alongside the highway on the right-hand side, there was a wall upon which John Paul II was painted on as a mural. And in this mural, he's just kind of like waving. He's waving his hand, and it's almost like saying, "Have a safe trip" to anybody that's headed to the airport, because the highway led to the airport. And on one of these days, as we're driving past it, I see the Pope, and I curse at him because I kind of make like this relation with the Pope, or this connection with the Pope to fathers, right? And so I kind of cursed him out loud, and my father heard as he was driving, and he thought I was talking to him. And I say to him, "I'm not talking to you. Are you the Pope? You're not the Pope, right?" But I tell him in Spanish, and in Spanish, Pope translates to papa, which means father, right? So I told him, "You're not the Pope. You're not. You're no eres el papa. You're not the Pope." And he says, "Yeah, I am your papa. I am the Pope." Right? So that's where that came from. So initially, he kind of liked it. He relished in the idea that I would call him El Papa, the Pope. And every time I said it to him or any of my brothers, or he came home and we would cheer on the Pope, he kind of would puff himself up, puff his chest out and raise his head and walk as if he was marching, ahead of a line of trumpet players or something. But after a while, he kind of got it that it was a joke, and that he was the butt of that joke, and that we weren't exalting him as the Pope. We were kind of making him a caricature of the Pope, a caricature of a father who was an alcoholic. And once he caught on to it, he was very resentful of it. But nonetheless, it stuck.
You've already explained that, alcoholism and addiction runs through your dad's side of the family. Have you ever tried to figure out why he was a drinker beyond whatever genetic proclivities he might have had?
Well, genetically, my grandfather Polo, he was a drinker as well. So the genetics are there, but and I've gotten some slack by some people who say that I criticize Mexico too much. And my answer to that is always, well, if you love something, you criticize it to make it better. And I love Mexico. It's my homeland. I love Chihuahua. When I die, I'd like to be buried there. But in it, well, I haven't been to all of Mexico, so I could only speak for Chihuahua. And Chihuahua, alcohol is everywhere. Liquor stores are everywhere. People drink just to get by the mundaneness, the monotony of the days. If you're not rich and you don't have money to go entertain yourself in other ways other than alcohol, alcohol is the primary source of entertainment. It's the primary source to forget that you're poor, to forget that you live in misery. So it's constantly there, more so than in poor communities here in Los Angeles, where, I mean, liquor stores are abundant as well. But in Chihuahua, you don't got to go too far to find a liquor store or to find a store that sells beer. So I think that plays a big role in it too, and in that, jobs are scarce. So it's just a formula for alcoholism. And so a lot of people drink, and I think that plays a big role into it as well. But with my father, I think a lot of it is more genetic, as it is with me.
Did he ever try to quit drinking?
Not that I know of, although I think once he went to rehab, and I think I mentioned this in the book, but he went only for a short time, and then after that he was back at it again. He didn't take it seriously. So I don't think my father ever crossed his mind that he would become sober one day.
There's actually a great story in the book of your dad attending AA meetings with your uncle, but just to support your uncle.
That's right. That's right. Just to support my uncle. And once he'd leave those meetings, the first place he'd want me to take him was to a liquor store so that he could buy some beer. And I made a comment to him like, "Well, you just left the AA meeting." He's like, "Yeah, but that was just in support of your uncle. It has nothing to do with me." That's the man my father was.
You write that drunks and mourners share a fanatical appreciation for talk about the past. What are the differences between the past as drunks recall it and the past as mourners recall it?
Well, I would say that mourners, well, the similarity, well, the similarity in mourners and drunks is that they're always remembering the great moments, right? They're always and recalling people as these wonderful people. But I would say that the difference is that, the drunks tend to embellish stories, and also embrace the bad stories and glorify them. Where mourners just kind of look at the good stories and want to hide the bad stories. They don't want to, eulogize somebody by telling bad stories or reliving bad memories. Whereas drunks just go with it. Everything is a remember when story. Remember when our dad would take us to the pool? Yeah, that was fantastic. But you also remember when, he would fight with Aaron? Yeah, I remember that. Right. So the stories would always. Bad or good, the drunk will tell them and will relish in them, whereas the mourner will just kind of look at the good stories and want to forget the bad.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So after your father's death, when you had put him in the ground and your family was sitting around remembering him and remembering what good things there were to remember, in the back of your mind, were you thinking the whole time, like, this is not the whole story? Maybe this is the kind of story you tell when someone has died, but it's not the whole story.
Yeah, of course, but I don't think I spent too much time just thinking about that because I think everybody there, or I'm certain that everybody at the funeral home knew who my father was, so they knew that, he wasn't just this good man. But it's kind of like the elephant in the room, right? Everybody knows, but nobody wants to say it. And if they say it, it's through their own drinking. As I describe in the book, everybody was drunk, except the children. But the adults, that's how we mourned. Open a bottle, open a kawama, open a tequila bottle. And so we were doing as the dead man did when he was alive. We drank.
Is there part of you that checks your drinking now against his so that if you're not drinking as much as he did, you're okay?
Yeah, I think so. I don't drink as much as my father drank, but I'm only 42. So I don't know if, by the time I reach 46, 47, that the alcoholism can consume me and overpower me to the extent that I'll let myself go the way my father did. Of course, it's not something that I want to happen. Every day I think, or I tell myself, stay sober, you're good. You want to live. Life is beautiful, man. You got a book. You're a professor. You're an artist. Like, why do you want to drink, right? These are things that I tell myself to help me not drink. But then there are those moments where the brain just tells you, hey, just have a drink. It's a beautiful sunny day outside. It's Saturday. You don't got nothing to do tomorrow. And then that drink turns out into a whole weekend of binging.
Parts of your relationship with your father do you carry around with you now?
I think the main one is my artistic talent. And it's something that I embrace fully. And I think in part is because I know how my father just let it go and how tragic that was to me, because I love art. And ever since I was a little kid, I used to love to draw. I love to draw, and I would always ask my mom to enroll me in art classes, but she never could because they were always expensive and supplies were expensive, so I never could. And that's why, when I'm leading up to my gang life, I started with graffiti, being a tagger, because I loved art. And that was one way of expressing myself artistically. But now, as an adult, I'm able to buy my own art supplies. And, I have a great art mentor, Fabian DeBoda, right here in Boyle Heights in Los Angeles. And so it's something that I just embrace just fully. And I'm constantly thinking about how proud my father would be seeing my own paintings. And that is kind of like the silver lining. That I believe that my father, had he lived long enough to see where I'm taking my artwork or my talent, I think he'd be really proud of me, and he'd love my paintings, and he'd probably hang them up on his house and his walls.
Writer Obed Silva is professor of English at East Los Angeles College. His memoir is called The Death of My Father, the Pope. Obed, this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you want to subscribe to the Think podcast, it is free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think or listen anytime at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.